first of a series of clotheslines, tugging his limbs and twitching him about before snapping. After what seemed an eternity of bone-wrenching jerks and the whip of cord slicing through his clothes and flaying his skin, Crocus struck the alley's cobblestones, straight-legged and leaning far forward. His knees buckled. He dipped a shoulder enough to earn a slightly cushioned roll, brought up short when his head struck a wall. Dazed and groaning, Crocus pushed himself upright. He looked up. Through vision blurred with pain, he saw a figure descending in seeming slow motion immediately overhead. The thief's eyes widened.
Sorcery!
He turned and staggered dizzily before managing a limping run down the alleyway. He reached the corner and, briefly lit by gaslight, hurried across a wide street, then entered the mouth of another alley. Once in its shadow, Crocus stopped. Cautiously, he poked his head out from the wall's edge for a look. A quarrel struck the brick beside his face. He jumped back into the alley, spun, and sprinted. Above him, Crocus heard the flapping of a cloak. A burning spasm in his left hip made him stumble. Another quarrel whipped past his shoulder and skidded on the cobblestones. The spasm passed as quickly as it had come, and he staggered on. Ahead, at the alley mouth, was the lit doorway of a tenement. An old woman sat on the stone steps, puffing on a pipe. Her eyes glittered as she watched the thief approach. As Crocus bounded past her and up the steps, she wrapped the pipe against the sole of her shoe. Sparks rained onto the cobbles. Crocus pushed open the door and plunged inside. He paused. A narrow, poorly lit hallway was before him, a staircase crowded with children at the far end. His eyes on the stairs, he jogged up the hall. From the curtained doorways on either side came a cacophony of noise. Voices raised in argument, wailing babies, the clatter of cookware.
"Don't you people ever sleep?"
Crocus shouted as he ran. The children on the stairs scampered out of his way, and he took the warped steps two at a time. On the top floor, he stopped at a door a third of the way down the hall, this one solid oak. He pushed it open and entered the room within. An old man sitting behind a massive desk looked up briefly from his work, then resumed his frantic scrawl on a sheet of crinkled parchment.
"Evening, Crocus," he said distractedly.
"And to you, Uncle,"
Crocus gasped. On Uncle Mammoth's shoulder squatted a small winged monkey, whose glittering half-mad gaze followed the young thief's dart across the room to the window opposite the door. Flinging open the shutters, Crocus climbed up onto the sill. Below was a squalid, overgrown garden, mostly lost in shadows. A lone, gnarled tree rose upward. He eyed the branches across from him, then gripped the window frame and leaned back. He drew a deep breath, then propelled himself forward. As he passed through the intervening gap, he heard a surprised grunt come from directly above, then a wild scratching against stone. An instant later, someone crashed down into the garden below. Cats shrieked, and a voice groaned out a single, pained curse. Crocus clung to a bowing branch. He timed each bounce of the resilient wood, then extended his legs as the branch pulled him up. His moccasins landed on a windowsill and held. Grunting, he swung himself onto it and let go of the branch. He punched at the wooden shutters. They sprang inward, and Crocus followed head first, down onto the floor and rolling to his feet. He heard movement from another room in the apartment. Scrambling to his feet, he bolted for the hallway door, flung it open, and slipped out just as a hoarse voice shouted a curse behind him. Crocus ran to the far end of the passage, where a ladder led to a hatch on the ceiling. Soon he was on the roof. He crouched in the darkness and tried to catch his breath. The burning sensation returned to his hip. He must have damaged something in his fall from the guide wire. He reached down to massage the spot and found his fingers pressing something hard, round, and hot. The coin. Crocus reached for it. Just then he heard a sudden whistling sound, and chips of stone spat at him. Ducking, he saw a quarrel, its shaft split by the impact, bounce once on the rooftop, then plummet over the edge, spinning wildly. A soft moan escaped his lips, and he scrambled across the roof to the far side.
Without pause, he jumped. 10 feet down was an awning, sagged and stretched out of shape, on which he landed. The iron spars framing the canvas dipped, but held. From there it was a quick climb down to the street. Crocus jogged to the corner, where an old building squatted with yellow light, bleeding through dirty windows. A wooden sign hung above the door, bearing the faded image of a bird dead on its back, feet jutting upward. The thief bounded up the steps and pushed open the door. A rush of light and noise washed over him like balm. He slammed the door behind him and leaned against it. He closed his eyes, pulling the disguising cloth from his face and head, revealing shoulder-length black hair, now dripping with sweat, and regular features surrounding light blue eyes. As he reached up to wipe his brow, a mug was pushed into his hand. Crocus opened his eyes to see Sultry hurry by, carrying on one hand a tray loaded with pewter tankards. She glanced at him over his shoulder and grinned.
"Rough night, Crocus."
He stared at her, then said,
"No, nothing special."
He raised the mug to his lips and drank deep. Across the street from the ramshackle Phoenix Inn, a hunter stood at the roof's edge and studied the door through which the thief had just passed. The crossbow lay cradled in its arms. The second hunter arrived, sheathing two long knives as it came alongside the first.
"What happened to you?"
the first hunter asked quietly in its native tongue.
"Had an argument with a cat."
The two were silent for a moment. Then the first hunter sighed worriedly.
"All in all, too awry to be natural."
The other agreed.
"You felt the parting too, then?"
"An ascendant, meddled. Too cautious to show itself fully, however."
"Unfortunate. It's been years since I last killed an ascendant."
They began to check their weapons. The first hunter loaded the crossbow and slipped four extra quarrels in its belt. The second hunter removed each long knife and cleaned it carefully of sweat and grime. They heard someone approach from behind and turned to see their commander.
"He's in the inn," the second hunter said.
"We'll leave no witnesses to this secret war with the guild,"
the first added. The commander glanced at the door of the Phoenix Inn. Then to the hunters she said,
"No, the wagging tongue of a witness might be useful to our efforts."
"The runt had help,"
the first hunter said meaningfully. The commander shook her head.
"We return to the fold."
"Very well."
The two hunters put away their weapons. The first glanced back at the inn and asked,
"Who protected him, do you think?"
The second hunter snarled,
"Someone with a sense of humor."
Chapter 6. There is a cabal breathing deeper than the bellows, drawing up the emerald fires beneath rain-glistened cobbles. While you may hear the groaning from the caverns below, the whisper of sorcery is less than the dying sigh of a thief stumbling unwilling into Darujistan's secret web. Cabal Fragment. Puddle, born circa 1122. The splayed tip of her right wing brushed the scarred black rock as Crone climbed the whistling updrafts of Moonspawn. From the pocked caves and starlit ledges, her restless brothers and sisters called out to her as she passed.
"Do we fly?"
they asked. But Crone made no reply. Her glittering black eyes were fixed on heaven's vault. Her enormous wings beat a thundering refrain of taut, unrelenting power. She had no time for the nervous cackling of the younglings, no time for answering their simplistic needs with the wisdom her thousands of years of life had earned her. This night, Crone flew for her lord.
As she rose above the shattered peaks of the moon's crest, a high wind swept her wings, rasping dry and cold along her oily feathers. Around her, Thin wisps of shredded smoke rode the currents of night air like lost spirits. Crone circled once, her sharp gaze catching the glimmer of the few remaining fires among the crags below. Then she dipped a wing and sailed out on the wind's tide as it rolled northward to Lake Azure. The featureless expanse of the dwelling plain was beneath her, the grass sweeping in grey waves unbroken by house or hill. Directly ahead lay the glittering jeweled cloak that was Darujistan, casting into the sky a sapphire glow. As she neared the city, her unnaturally acute vision detected here and there among the estates crowding the upper tier the aquamarine emanation of sorcery. Crone cackled aloud. Magic was ambrosia to great ravens. They were drawn to it by the scent of blood and power, and within its aura their lifespans lengthened into centuries. Its musk had other effects as well. Crone cackled again, her gaze fixed on one particular estate, around which glowed a profusion of protective sorcery. Her lord had imparted to her a thorough description of the magical signature she must find, and now she had found it. Crooking her wings, she sank gracefully toward the estate. Inland from Gadrobi District's harbor, the land rose in four tiers climbing eastward. Ramped cobblestone streets, worn to a polished mosaic, marked Gadrobi District's trade streets, five in all, which were the only routes through Marsh District and into the next tier, Lakefront District. Beyond Lakefront's crooked aisles, 12 wooden gates opened onto Daru District, and from Daru, another 12 gates. These ones manned by the city watch and barred by iron portcullis, connected the lower and upper cities. On the fourth and highest tier brooded the estates of Darujistan's nobility, as well as its publicly known sorcerers. At the intersection of Old King's Walk and View Street rose a flat-topped hill on which sat Majesty Hall, where each day the council gathered. A narrow park encircled the hill, with sand-strewn pathways winding among centuries-old acacias. At the park's entrance, near High Gallows Hill, stood a massive, rough-hewn stone gate, the last surviving remnant of the castle that once commanded Majesty Hill. The days of kings had long since ended in Darujistan. The gate, known as Despot's Barbican, stood stark and unadorned, its lattice of cracks a fading script of past tyranny. In the shadow of the Barbican's single massive lintel stone stood two men. One, his shoulder against the pitted rock, wore a ringed hauberk and a boiled leather cap bearing the city watch insignia. Scabbarded to his belt was a plain short sword, its grip of wrapped leather worn smooth. A pike leaned against one shoulder. He was nearing the end of his midnight guard duty and patiently awaited the arrival of the man who would officially relieve him. The guard's eyes flicked on occasion to the second man, with whom he had shared this place many another night over the past year. The glances he cast at the well-dressed gentleman were surreptitious, empty of expression. As with every other time, Councilman Turban Orr came to the gate at this dead hour of night. The nobleman had scarcely deemed the guard worthy of notice. Nor had he ever given an indication that he recognized the guard as being the same man each time. Turban Orr seemed a man short on patience, forever pacing and fretting, pausing every now and then to adjust his jeweled burgundy cloak. The councilman's polished boots clicked as he paced, throwing a soft echo under the barbican. From the shadow, the guard's gaze caught Orr's gloved hand, where it rested on the silver pommel of a dueling sword, noting the index finger tapping in time with the boot clicks. At the early part of his watch, long before the arrival of the councilman, the guard would walk slowly around the barbican, reaching out on occasion to touch the ancient grim stonework. 6 years' worth of night watch at this gate had bred a close relationship between the man and the rough-cut basalt. He knew every crack, every chisel scar. He knew where the fittings had weakened, where time and the elements had squeezed mortar from between the stones that gnawed it to dust. And he also knew that its apparent weaknesses were but a deception. The Barbican, and all it stood for, patiently waited still, a spectre of the past, hungry to be born yet again. And that, the guard had long ago vowed, he would never let it do, if such things were within his power. Despot's Barbican provided the man with every reason he needed to be what he was. Circle breaker. A spy. Both he and the councilman awaited the arrival of the other, the one who never failed to appear. Turban Orr would growl his usual complaint, disgusted with tardiness. Then he would grasp the other's arm, and they would walk side by side beneath the Barbican's brooding lintel stone. And, with eyes long accustomed to darkness, the guard would mark the other's face, burning it indelibly in the superb memory hidden behind expressionless, unmemorable features. By the time the two council members returned from their walk, the guard would have been relieved and well on his way to delivering a message according to his master's instructions. If Circle Breaker's luck held, he might survive the civil war into which Darujistan, he felt, was about to plunge. And never mind the Malazan nemesis. One nightmare at a time, he often told himself, particularly on nights like these, when Despot's Barbican seemed to breathe its promise of resurrection with mocking certainty.
"As this may be in your interest," High Alchemist Baruch read aloud from the parchment note in his plump hands.
Always the same opening line, hinting of disquieting knowledge. An hour earlier, his servant Roald had delivered the note, which, like all the others that had come to him over the past year, had been found tucked into one of the ornamental murder holes in the estate's rear postern gate. Recognizing the pattern, Baruch had immediately read the missive, then dispatched his messengers out into the city. Such news demanded action, and he was one of the few secret powers within Darujistan capable of dealing with it. Now he sat in a plush chair in his study, musing. His deceptively sleepy gaze flicked down again to the words on the parchment.
"Councilman Turban Orr walks in the garden with Councilman Fedder. I remain known only as Circle Breaker, a servant of the Eel, whose interests continue to coincide with your own."
Once again, Baruch felt temptation. With his talents, it would be a small thing to discover the writer's identity. Though not the Eel's, of course. That was an identity sought by many, all to no avail. But, as always, something held him back. He shifted his bulk on the chair and sighed.
Very well, Circle Breaker. I'll continue to honor you, though clearly you know more of me than I of you. And fortunate it is indeed that your master's interests coincide with my own. Still.
He frowned, thinking about the Eel. About the man's or woman's undisclosed interests. He knew enough to recognize that too many forces had come into play. A gathering of ascendant powers was a fell thing. To continue to step unseen in defense of the city was becoming increasingly difficult. So, the question came yet again. Was this Eel using him as well? Oddly enough, he did not feel too concerned about this possibility. So much vital information had been passed into his hands already. He folded the parchment carefully and muttered a simple cantrip. The note vanished with a small plop of displaced air, joining the others in a safe place. Baruch closed his eyes. Behind him, the broad window shutters rattled in a gust of wind, then settled again. A moment later, there came a sharp rap against the smoky glass. Baruch sat upright, his eyes startled open. A second rap, louder than the first, brought him round with a swift alacrity, surprising for one of his girth. On his feet, he faced the window. Something crouched on the ledge. visible through the shutters only as a bulky black shape. Baruch frowned.
Impossible.
Nothing could penetrate his magic barriers undetected. The alchemist gestured with one hand, and the shutters sprang open. Behind the glass waited a great raven. Its head snapped to view Baruch with one eye, then the other. It pushed boldly against the thin glass with its massive, ridged chest. The pane bulged, then shattered. His warren fully open, Baruch raised both hands, a savage spell on his lips.
"Don't waste your breath,"
the raven rasped, swelling its chest and ruffling its mangy feathers to rid itself of glass shards. It cocked its head.
"You've called your guards," it observed. "No need, wizard."
A single hop brought the enormous bird onto the floor.
"I bring words you will value. Have you anything to eat?"
Baruch studied the creature.
"I'm not in the habit of inviting great ravens into my home," he said. "You are no disguised demon either."
"Of course not. I'm named Crone."
Her head bobbed mockingly.
"At your pleasure, Lord."
Baruch hesitated, considering. After a moment he sighed and said,
"Very well. I've returned my guards to their posts. My servant Roald comes with the leavings of supper, if that's agreeable to you."
"Excellent."
Crone waddled across the floor to settle on the rug before the fireplace.
"There, Lord. Now, a calming crystal of wine, don't you think?"
"Who has sent you, Crone?"
Baruch asked, walking over to the decanter on his desk. Normally he did not drink after sunset, for night was when he worked, but he had to acknowledge Crone's perceptiveness. A calming balm was exactly what he needed. The great raven hesitated slightly before answering.
"The Lord of Moonspawn."
Baruch paused in the filling of his glass.
"I see," he said quietly, struggling to control his surging heart.
He set the decanter down slowly and with great concentration raised the goblet to his lips. The liquid was cool on his tongue, and its passage down his throat indeed calmed him.
"Well then," he said, turning, "what would your lord have of a peaceful alchemist?"
Crone's chipped beak opened in what Baruch realized was silent laughter. The bird fixed a single glittering eye on him.
"Your answer rode the very breath of your words, Lord. Peace. My lord wishes to speak with you. He wishes to come here this very night, within the hour."
"And you're to await my answer?"
"Only if you decide quickly, Lord. I have things to do, after all. I'm more than a simple message bearer. Those who know wisdom when they hear it hold me dear. I am Crone, eldest of the moon's great ravens, whose eyes have looked upon 100,000 years of human folly. Hence my tattered coat and broken beak, as evidence of your indiscriminate destruction. I am but a winged witness to your eternal madness."
In quiet mockery, Baruch said,
"More than just a witness. It's well known how you and your kind feasted on the plain outside Pale's walls."
"Yet we were not the first to feast on flesh and blood, Lord, lest you forget."
Baruch turned away.
"Far be it for me to defend my species," he muttered,
more to himself than to Crone, whose words had stung him. His eyes fell on the shards of glass littering the floor. He voiced a mending spell and watched as they reassembled.
"I will speak with your lord, Crone."
He nodded as the glass pane rose from the floor and returned to the window frame.
"Tell me, will he as easily disdain my wards as you did?"
"My lord is possessed of honor and courtesy,"
Crone replied ambiguously.
"I shall call him, then."
"Do so,"
Baruch said, sipping his wine.
An avenue will be provided for his passage.
There came a knock at the door.
Yes?
Roald stepped inside.
Someone is at the gate wishing to speak with you,
the white-haired servant said, setting down a plate heaped with roast pork. Baruch glanced at Crone and raised an eyebrow. The bird ruffled her feathers.
Your guest is mundane, a restless personage whose thoughts are thick with greed and treachery. A demon crouches on his shoulder, named Ambition.
His name, Roald? Baruch asked.
The servant hesitated. His soft eyes flicked uneasily at the bird now ambling toward the food.
Baruch laughed. My wise guest's counsel indicates she well knows the man's name. Speak on, Roald.
Councilman Turban Orr. I would remain for this, Crone said, if you would seek my counsel.
Please do, and yes, I would, the alchemist replied.
I am no more than a pet dog,
the great raven crooned slyly, anticipating his next question.
To the councilman's eyes, that is. My words are beast's whimper to his ears.
She speared a piece of meat and swallowed it quickly. Baruch found himself beginning to like this mangy old witch of a bird.
Bring the councilman to us, Roald.
The servant departed. Archaic torches lit an estate's high-walled garden with a flickering light that threw wavering shadows across the pavestones. As a night wind swept in from the lake, rustling leaves, the shadows danced like imps. On the second floor of the building was a balcony overlooking the garden. Behind the curtain window, two figures moved. Ralik Nom lay prone on the garden wall in a niche of darkness beneath the estate's gabled cornice. He studied the feminine silhouette with the patience of a snake. It was the fifth night in a row that he had occupied his hidden vantage point. The Lady Simtal's lovers numbered as many, but he had identified two in particular worthy of attention. Both were city councilmen. The glass door opened and a figure walked out onto the balcony. Ralik smiled as he recognized Councilman Lim. The assassin shifted position slightly, slipping one gloved hand under the stock of his crossbow, reaching up with the other to swing back the oiled crank. His eyes on the man leaning against the balcony railing across from him, Ralik carefully inserted a quarrel. A glance down at the bolt's iron head reassured him. The poison glittered wetly along the razor-sharp edges. Returning his attention to the balcony, he saw that Lady Simtal had joined Lim. No wonder there's no shortage of lovers for that one, Ralik thought, his eyes narrowing in study. Her black hair, now unpinned, flowed down sleek and shiny to the small of her back. She wore a gauze-thin nightdress, and with the lamps of the room behind her, her body's round curves were clearly visible. As they spoke, their voices carried to where Ralik lay hidden.
Why the alchemist?
Lady Simtal was asking, evidently resuming a conversation begun inside.
A fat old man, smelling of sulfur and brimstone, hardly suggestive for political power. Not even a council member, is he?
Lim laughed softly.
Your naivety is a charm, lady, a charm.
Simtal pulled back from the railing and crossed her arms.
Educate me, then.
Her words came sharp, tightly bridled. Lim shrugged.
We have naught but suspicions, lady. But it is the wise wolf that follows every spore, no matter how slight. The alchemist would have people think as you do. A doddering old fool.
Lim paused, as if in thought, perhaps weighing how much she should reveal.
We have sources, he continued cautiously, among the majory. They inform us of one certain fact, heavy with implications. A good many of the wizards in the city fear the alchemist, and they name him by a title.
That alone suggests a secret cabal of some sort. A gathering of sorcerers, lady, is a fell thing.
Lady Simtal had returned to the councilman's side. Both now leaned on the railing, studying the dark garden below. The woman was silent for a time. Then she said,
"He has council ties?" "If he has, the evidence is buried deep."
Lim flashed a grin.
"And if he hasn't, then that might change. This very night."
"Politics," Ralik snarled silently. "And power. The bitch spreads her legs to the council, offering advice few can ignore."
Ralik's hands twitched. He would kill this knight. Not a contract. The guild had no part in this. The vendetta was personal. She was gathering power around her, insulating herself, and Ralik thought he understood why. The ghosts of betrayal would not leave her alone.
"Patience," he reminded himself as he took aim.
For the last 2 years, the life of Lady Simtal had been one of indolence. The riches she had stolen had served to whet her every greed, and the prestige as sole owner of the estate had done much to grease the hinges of her bedroom door. The crime she had committed had not been against Ralik, but unlike her victim, Ralik had no pride to halt vengeance.
"Patience," Ralik repeated,
his lips moving to the word as he sighted down the crossbow's length. A quality defined by its reward, and that reward was but moments away.
"A fine-looking hound," Councilman Turbinor said, as he handed Roald his cloak. In the room, Baruch was the only one capable of discerning the aura of illusion surrounding the black hunting dog lying curled on the rug before the fireplace. The alchemist smiled and gestured to a chair.
"Please be seated, Councilman."
"I apologize for disturbing you so late at night," Orr said, as he lowered himself into the plush chair.
Baruch sat down opposite him, crone between them.
"It's said," Orr continued, "that alchemy flowers best in deep darkness."
"Hence you gambled on my being awake," Baruch said. "A well-placed wager, Councilman. Now, what would you have of me?"
Orr reached down to pat Crone's head. Baruch looked away to keep himself from laughing.
"The council votes in 2 days," Orr said, "with a proclamation of neutrality such as we seek. War with the Malazine Empire will be averted. So we believe, but there are those in the council who do not. Pride has made them belligerent, unreasonable."
"As it does us all," murmured Baruch.
Orr leaned forward.
"The support of Darujistan's sorcerers would do much to favor our cause," he said.
"Careful," Crone rumbled. "This man now hunts in earnest."
Orr glanced down at the dog.
"A bad leg," Baruch said. "Pay it no mind."
The alchemist leaned back in his chair and plucked a loose thread on his robe.
"I admit to some confusion, Councilman. You appear to be assuming some things I cannot countenance."
Baruch spread his hands and met Orr's eyes.
"Darujistan's sorcerers, for one. You could travel the 10 worlds and not find a more spiteful, rabid collection of humanity. Oh, I don't suggest that they are all like this. There are those whose only interest, indeed obsession, lies in the pursuit of their craft. Their noses have been buried in books so long, they could not even tell you what century this is. The others find bickering their only true pleasure in life."
A smile had come to Orr's thin lips as Baruch spoke.
"But," he said with a cunning gleam in his dark eyes, "there is one thing they all acknowledge."
"Oh? What is that, Councilman?"
"Pa, we're all aware of your eminence among the city's mages, Baruch. Your word alone would bring others."
"I'm flattered that you would think so.
Baruch replied.
Unfortunately, therein lies your second erroneous assumption. Even if I had such influence as you suggest...
Crone snorted, and Baruch flicked a savage glare at her, then continued,
which I do not. For what possible reason would I support such a willfully ignorant position as yours? A proclamation of neutrality? Might as well whistle against the wind, Councilman. What purpose would it serve?
Orr's smile had tightened.
Surely, Lord, he purred. You have no wish to share the same fate as the Wizards of Pale?
Baruch frowned.
What do you mean?
Assassinated by an Empire claw. Moonspawn was entirely on its own against the Empire.
Your information contradicts mine, Baruch said stiffly, then cursed himself.
Lean not too heavily on this one, Crone said smugly. You are both wrong.
Orr's eyebrows had risen at Baruch's words.
Indeed. Perhaps it might profit us both to share our information.
Unlikely, Baruch said. Throwing the threat of the Empire at me implies what? That if the proclamation is voted down, the city's sorcerers will die at the Empire's hand. But if it wins, you're free to justify opening the gates to the Malazans in peaceful coexistence. And in such a scenario, the city's majory lives on.
Astute, Lord, Crone said.
Baruch studied the anger now visible beneath Orr's expression.
Neutrality. How you've managed to twist that word. Your proclamation serves the first step towards total annexation, Councilman. Fortunate for you that I cast no weight, no vote, no influence.
Baruch rose.
Roald will see you out.
Turban Orr also rose.
You've made a grave error, he said. The proclamation's wording is not yet complete. It seems we would do well to remove any consideration regarding Darujistan's majory.
Too bold, Crone observed. Prod him, and see what more comes forth.
Baruch strode toward the window.
One may only hope, he said dryly over a shoulder, that your vote fails to win the day.
Orr's reply was hot and rushed.
By my count, we've reached a majority this very night, Alchemist. You could have provided the honey on the cream. Alas, he sneered, we'll win by only one vote. But that will suffice.
Baruch turned to face Orr as Roald quietly entered the room, bearing the councilman's cloak. Crone stretched out on the rug.
On this night of all nights, she said in mock dismay, to tempt myriad fates with such words.
The great raven cocked her head. Faintly, as from a great distance, she thought she could hear the spinning of a coin. There was a tremble of power coming from somewhere within the city, and Crone shivered. Ralik Nom waited. No more indolence for the Lady Simtal. The end of such luxuries came this night. The two figures moved away from the railing and faced the glass door. Ralik's finger tightened on the trigger. He froze. A whirring, spinning sound filled his head, whispering words that left him bathed in sudden sweat. All at once, everything shifted, turned over in his mind. His plan for quick vengeance tumbled into disarray, and from the ruins arose something far more elaborate. All this had come between breaths. Ralik's gaze cleared. Lady Simtal and Councilman Lim stood at the door. The woman reached out to slide the panel to one side. Ralik swerved his crossbow an inch to the left, then squeezed the trigger. The blackened iron rib of the bow bucked with the release of tension. The quarrel sped outward, so fast as to be invisible until it hit home. A figure on the balcony spun with the quarrel's impact, arms thrown out as it stumbled. The glass door shattered as the figure fell through it. Lady Simtal screamed in horror. Ralik waited no longer. Rolling onto his back, he reached up and slid the crossbow into the narrow ledge between the cornice and the roof. Then he slipped down the outside of the wall, hung with his hands briefly, as shouts of alarm filled the estate. A moment later he dropped, spinning as he fell, and landed cat-like in the alley. The assassin straightened, adjusted his cloak, then calmly walked into the side street, away from the estate. No more indolence for the Lady Simtal. But no quick demise either. A very powerful, very well-respected member of the city council had just been assassinated on her balcony. Lim's wife, now widow, would certainly have something to say about this. The first phase, Ralik told himself as he strode through Osirk's gate and descended the wide ramp leading down into the Daru district. Just the first phase, an opening gambit, a hint to Lady Simtal that a hunt has begun, with the eminent mistress herself as the quarry.
It won't be easy. The woman's no slouch in the intrigue game,
Ralik thought.
There'll be more blood,
he whispered aloud as he turned a corner and approached the poorly lit entrance to the Phoenix Inn.
But in the end she'll fall, and with that fall, an old friend will rise.
As he neared the inn, a figure stepped from the shadows of an adjacent alleyway. Ralik stopped. The figure gestured, then stepped back into the darkness. Ralik followed. In the alley, he waited for his eyes to adjust. The man in front of him sighed.
Your vendetta probably saved your life tonight,
he said, his tone bitter. Ralik leaned against a wall and crossed his arms.
Oh?
Clan leader Ocelot stepped close. His narrow, pitted face twisted into its habitual scowl.
The night's been a shambles, Norm. You've heard nothing?
No.
Ocelot's thin lips curled into a humorless smile.
A war has begun on the rooftops. Someone is killing us. We lost 5 roamers in less than an hour, meaning there's more than one killer out there.
Undoubtedly, Ralik replied,
fidgeting as the damp stones of the inn's wall reached through his cloak and touched his flesh with chill. As always, guild affairs bored him. Ocelot continued.
We lost that bull of a man, Tarlo Crafer, and a clan leader.
The man snapped a glance over his shoulder, as if expecting a sudden dagger to come flashing at his own back. Despite his lack of interest, Ralik's eyebrows lifted at this last bit of news.
They must be good.
Good? All of our eyewitnesses are dead, goes the sour joke this night. They don't make mistakes, the bastards.
Everyone makes mistakes, Ralik muttered. Has Vorkan gone out?
Ocelot shook his head.
Not yet. She's too busy recalling all the clans.
Ralik frowned, curious in spite of himself.
Could this be a challenge to her guild mastery? Perhaps an inside thing? A rival faction?
You think we're all fools, don't you, Nom? That was Vorkan's first suspicion. No, it's not internal. Whoever's killing our people is from outside the guild, outside the city.
To Ralik, the answer seemed obvious suddenly, and he shrugged.
An empire claw, then.
Though his expression bore reluctance, Ocelot nevertheless acknowledged agreement.
Likely, he grated. They're supposed to be the best, aren't they? But why go after the guild? You'd think they'd be taking out the nobles.
Are you asking me to guess the empire's intentions, Ocelot?
The clan leader blinked, then his scowl deepened.
I came to warn you, and that's a favor, Nom. With you wrapped up in this vendetta thing, the guild's not obliged to spread its wing over you. A favor.
Ralik pushed himself from the wall and turned to the alley mouth.
A favor, Ocelot?
He laughed softly.
We're setting a trap,
Ocelot said, moving to block Ralik's way. He jerked his scarred chin at the Phoenix Inn.
Make yourself visible, and leave no doubt as to what you do for a living.
Ralek's gaze on Ocelot held steady, impassive.
Bait. Just do it.
Without replying, Ralek left the alley, climbed the steps, and entered the Phoenix Inn.
There is a shaping in the night, Crone said,
after Turban Or had left. The air around her shimmered as she assumed her true shape. Baruch strode to his map table, hands clasped behind his back, to still the trembling that had seized them.
You felt it too, then.
He paused, then sighed.
All in all, these seem the busiest hours.
A convergence of power ever yields thus, Crone said,
as she rose to stretch her wings.
The black winds gather, alchemist. Beware their flaying breath.
Baruch grunted.
While you ride them, a harbinger of our tragic ills.
Crone laughed. She waddled to the window.
My master comes. I've other tasks before me.
Baruch turned.
Permit me, he said, gesturing.
The window swung clear. Crone flapped up onto the sill. She swiveled her head round and cocked an eye at Baruch.
I see 12 ships riding a deep harbour, she said. 11 stand tall in flames.
Baruch stiffened. He had not anticipated a prophecy. Now he was afraid.
And the 12th?
He asked, his voice barely a whisper.
On the wind, a hailstorm of sparks fill the night sky. I see them spinning, spinning about the last vessel.
Crone paused.
Still spinning.
Then she was gone. Baruch's shoulders slumped. He turned back to the map on the table and studied the 11 once free cities that now bore the Empire flag. Only Darujistan remained, the 12th and last, marked by a flag that was not burgundy and grey.
The passing of freedom, he murmured.
Suddenly the walls around him groaned, and Baruch gasped as an enormous weight seemed to press down on him. The blood pounded in his head, lancing him with pain. He gripped the edge of the map table to steady himself. The incandescent globes of light suspended from the ceiling dimmed, then flickered out. In the darkness, the alchemist heard cracks sweeping down the walls, as if a giant's hand had descended on the building. All at once, the pressure vanished. Baruch raised a shaking hand to his sweat-slicked brow. A soft voice spoke behind him.
Greetings, High Alchemist. I am the Lord of Moonspawn.
Still facing the table, Baruch closed his eyes and nodded.
The title isn't necessary, he whispered. Please call me Baruch.
I am at home in darkness, the Lord said. Will this prove an inconvenience, Baruch?
The alchemist muttered a spell. Before him, the details of the map on the table took on distinction, emanating a cool blue glow. He faced the Lord and was startled to discover that the tall, cloaked figure reflected as little heat as the room's inanimate objects. Nevertheless, he was able to distinguish quite clearly the man's features.
"You're Tista Andy," he said.
The Lord bowed slightly. His angled, multi-hued eyes scanned the room.
"Have you any wine, Baruch?"
"Of course, Lord."
The alchemist walked over to his desk.
"My name, as best as it can be pronounced by humans, is Anomander Rake."
The Lord followed Baruch to the desk, his boots clicking on the polished marble floor. Baruch poured wine, then turned to study Rake with some curiosity. He had heard that Tista Andii warriors were fighting the Empire up north, commanded by a savage beast of a man named Caladan Brood. They had allied with the Crimson Guard, and together, the two forces were decimating the Malazans. So there were Tista Andii in Moonspawn, and the man standing before him was their lord. This moment marked the first time Baruch had ever seen a Tista Andi'i face to face. He was more than a little disturbed. Such remarkable eyes, he thought. One moment a deep hue of amber, cat-like and unnerving. The next, grey and banded like a snake's. A fell rainbow of colours to match any mood. He wondered if they were capable of lying. In the alchemist's library lay copies of the surviving tomes of Gothos Folly, Jaghut writings from millennia past. In them, Tista Andi'i were mentioned here and there in an aura of fear, Baruch recalled. Gothos himself, a Jaghut wizard who had descended the deepest warrens of elder magic, had praised the gods of the time that the Tista Andi'i were so few in number. And if anything, the mysterious black-skinned race had dwindled since then. Anamanda Rake's skin was jet black, befitting Gothos' descriptions, but his mane flowed silver. He stood close to 7 feet tall. His features were sharp, as if cut from onyx, a slight upward tilt to the large vertical pupilled eyes. A two-handed sword was strapped to Rake's broad back, its silver dragon skull pommel and archaic cross-hilt jutting from a wooden scabbard fully 6.5 feet long. From the weapon bled power, staining the air like black ink in a pool of water. As his gaze rested on it, Baruch almost reeled, seeing for a brief moment a vast darkness yawning before him, cold as the heart of a glacier, from which came the stench of antiquity and a faint, groaning sound. Baruch wrenched his eyes from the weapon, looked up to find Rake studying him from over one shoulder. The Tista Andi'i quirked a knowing smile, then handed Baruch one of the wine-filled goblets. Was Crone her usual melodramatic self? Baruch blinked, then could not help but grin. Rake sipped his wine. She's never been modest in displaying her talents. Shall we sit? Of course, Baruch replied, relaxing in spite of his trepidation. From his years of study, the alchemist knew that great power shaped different souls differently. Had Rake's been twisted, Baruch would have known immediately. But the Lord's control seemed absolute. That alone engendered awe. The man shaped his power, not the other way around. Such control was, well, inhuman. He suspected that this would not be the first insight he'd have regarding this warrior mage that would leave him astonished and frightened. She threw everything she had at me, Rake said suddenly. The Tista Andi's eyes shone green as glacial ice. Startled by the vehemence of that outburst, Baruch frowned. She? Oh, the Empress, of course, he thought. And even then, Rake continued, she couldn't bring me down. The alchemist stiffened in his chair.
Yet, he said cautiously, you were driven back, battered and beaten. I can feel your power, Anamanda Rake,
he added, grimacing.
It pulses from you like waves, so I must ask, how is it you were defeated? I know something of the Empire's High Mage Tayshron. He has power, but it's no match to yours, so again I ask, how?
His gaze on the map table, Rake replied, I've committed my sorcerers and warriors to Brood's North campaign. He turned a humorless grin on Baruch. Within my city are children, priests, and 3 elderly, exceedingly bookish warlocks.
City? Baruch thought. There was a city within Moonspawn?
A dun tone had entered Rake's eyes.
I cannot defend an entire moon. I cannot be everywhere at once. And as for Tayshren, he didn't give a damn about the people around him. I thought to dissuade him, make the price too high.
He shook his head as if perplexed, then he looked to Baruch.
To save the home of my people, I retreated.
Leaving Pale to fall.
Baruch shut his mouth, cursing his lack of tact. But Rake merely shrugged.
I didn't anticipate that I'd face a full assault. My presence alone had been keeping the Empire at bay for almost 2 years.
I've heard the Empress is short of patience, murmured Baruch thoughtfully.
His eyes narrowed, then he looked up.
You have asked to meet with me, Anomander Rake, and so here we are. What is it you wish from me?
An alliance, the Moon's Lord answered.
With me? Personally?
No games, Baruch.
Rake's voice was suddenly cold.
I'm not fooled by that council of idiots bickering at Majesty Hall. I know that it's you and your fellow mages who rule Darujistan.
He rose and glared down with eyes of grey.
I'll tell you this. For the Empress, your city is the lone pearl on this continent of mud. She wants it, and what she wants, she usually gets.
Baruch reached down and plucked at the frayed edge of his rope.
I see, he said in a low voice. Pale had its wizards.
Rake frowned.
Indeed.
Yet, Baruch continued, when the battle was begun in earnest, your first thought was not for the alliance you made with the city, but for the well-being of your moon.
Who told you this?
Rake demanded. Baruch looked up and raised both hands.
Some of those wizards managed to escape.
They're in the city.
Rake's eyes had gone black. Seeing them, Baruch felt sweat break out beneath his clothes.
Why?
He asked.
I want their heads,
Rake replied casually. He refilled his goblet and took a sip. An icy hand had slipped around Baruch's heart and was now tightening. His headache had increased tenfold in the last few seconds.
Why?
He asked again, the word coming out almost as a gasp. If Fatista Andy knew of the alchemist's sudden discomfort, he made no sign of it.
Why?
He seemed to roll the world in his mouth like wine, a light smile touching his lips.
When the Maranth army came down from the mountains, and Taishren rode at the head of his wizard cadre, and when word spread that an Empire claw had infiltrated the city,
Rake's smile twisted into a snarl.
The wizards of Pale fled.
He paused as if reliving memories.
I dispatched the claw when they were but a dozen steps inside the walls.
He paused again, his face betraying a flash of regret.
Had the city's wizards remained, the assault would have been repelled. Taishren, it seemed, was preoccupied with other imperatives. He had saturated his position, a hilltop, with defensive wards. Then he unleashed demons, not against me, but against some of his companions. That baffled me. But rather than allow such conjurings to wander at will, I expended vital power destroying them.
He sighed and said,
I pulled the moon back mere minutes from its destruction. I left it to drift south and went after those wizards.
After them?
I tracked down all but two.
Rake gazed at Baruch.
I want those two, preferably alive, but their heads will suffice.
You killed those you found.
How? With my sword, of course.
Baruch recoiled as if struck.
Oh, he whispered. Oh.
The Alliance,
Rake said, before draining his goblet.
I'll speak to the Cabal on this matter,
Baruch answered, rising shakily to his feet. Word of the decision will be sent to you soon.